Today is Thursday, November 14th. We're going to review some parasympathetic and sympathetic information before we wrap up chapter 14. Just want to repeat something to give us perspective for where we're at. We are talking about an autonomic nervous system division, and this division is a motor division. Keep in mind that this is all involuntarily controlled activity. We'll talk about somatic, you know, because that's skeletal muscle activity, but the real focus today is going to be on autonomic activity. How do we control muscle activity and glands and organs, you know, subconsciously or unconsciously? Okay, so what kinds of events will put you into sympathetic mode? E events, right? So if you're excited, if you're embarrassed, if you are surprised, emergency situations can also put us into this kind of sympathetic mode. So these E words are good to remember for the ones that drift you into that sympathetic dominance of your autonomic nervous system. So when you're in sympathetic mode, we have a set of nerves take over our body's control. And are those nerves cranial nerves or are they spinal nerves? They are spinal nerves, good. And so they are going to be a special set of spinal nerves. They're not just all the spinal nerves. They're a region right in your chest and thoracic area. And we call those the thoracic and lumbar spinal nerves that take control of us when we're in the sympathetic mode. What messages are sent to your heart and to your lungs? What do we tell your heart rate to do when you're in sympathetic mode? Yeah, speed it up, good, increase. We tell your breathing rate to increase, indirectly we do it another way. And what do we tell your digestive organs to do? Calm down, decrease, right? So the focus right now is to make sure that you have enough blood going to your heart and lungs to be able to put up a fight or to run for it with flight. So this, of course, triggers our fight or flight response. Good. Just a little detail here. The preganglionic neurons and postganglionic neurons are a little different for the sympathetic and parasympathetic systems. The preganglionic neurons are actually fairly short here in the sympathetic nervous system, and the postganglionic neurons are the actual long ones. So where does the ganglion sit when you're talking about the sympathetic nervous system? Close, yep, close to the spinal cord, good. So just a detail there to keep straight for this sympathetic nervous system. All right, so besides increasing heart rate and mental activity, what are some other effects that we feel when we've had a sympathetic nervous system response kick in? Metabolism increases. May not necessarily feel that. Blood pressure will increase. We also see digestive and urinary functions take a back seat because we really don't need those to be the primary focus when we're doing a survival mode fight or flight. So would you feel sleepy when sympathetic nervous system is controlling you? Right? Nobody ever fell asleep going for a run, right? So this system's definitely going to keep you alert, awake. It's going to keep you juiced up with energy while you do whatever it is you need to do, fight or flight here. All right, so let's flip onto the other side. Let's talk about parasympathetic nervous system control. What kinds of activities are favored during this branch of the autonomic nervous system's dominance? Yeah, digestion, defecation, and diuresis, which is making urine. This is what we call our rest and digest system, and it favors us being in a resting or a digesting mode. This is not fight or flight. This is not a response to an emergency. This is just relaxing. This is calm. So because this is a calm state of mind, we have a different set of nerves that dominate during parasympathetic control. Are these cranial or are these spinal nerves? They're cranial nerves, good. You'll notice the cranial nerves in control are just a subset, not all of them, and they will innervate your heart, your lungs, your digestive organs. This time, we send a message to your heart and lungs telling them to do what? Calm down, yep. Slow down, calm down, decrease, right. And this time, the message is sent to your digestive organs telling them to speed up, right? So we actually reverse the way the blood is going. during parasympathetic mode, we favor blood going to our digestive organs. Interesting to note, something you'll learn in Bio 211, that this vagus nerve, part of that solar nerve plexus, is the major dominant force over your heart. And being such, it's normally telling your heart rate to go in which direction, down or up. If vagus works for the parasympathetic response, go down. Yeah, it normally tells the heart rate to go down. So if you are a well-exercised athlete, then your heart rate's going to be lower than everybody else. It's going to be like 40s or 50s or perhaps even lower. And that's because the parasympathetic nervous system is going to make sure that the heart is working most efficiently as a pump and keep that heart rate lower. For everybody else, you know, a normal heart rate is 75, but that vagus nerve is the primary dominant force in terms of keeping your heart rate low. So all good stuff for Bio 211 there. All right, so in terms of the preganglionic neurons here, they are long, and the postganglionic neurons are short. So with parasympathetic response, where does that ganglion sit closer to? The organs, right? So it's a ganglion closer to those organs. Good. Okay, so I think of these two systems as battling systems. One's going to try to dominate you. And of course, they are both ways to control motor responses for our autonomic or involuntarily controlled organs. Things like smooth muscle, gland, things of that sort are controlled through these two pathways. Okay, so that should take us through page 123. There is a chart on the next page. Before we head there, how about questions? Anything I can clarify or repeat? Okay, so let's talk about neurotransmitters once again. We are familiar with acetylcholine. That's an old one we discussed back with muscles. And so we now have two more to add to this conversation. We have epinephrine and norepinephrine. Epinephrine is oftentimes called adrenaline, and its buddy norepinephrine is called noradrenaline. Go ahead and tell you these two are made and released by your adrenal glands. Do you know where those adrenal glands are situated? They've got the word renal in there, so they're on top of the kidneys. So epinephrine and norepinephrine are made by the adrenal glands. Those glands sit on tops of your kidneys. All right, so adrenaline and noradrenaline, or epinephrine and norepinephrine, bind to a certain set of receptors, and they are called adrenergic receptors. And that's why I make the point that the alternate name there is adrenaline. If you keep in mind adrenaline and adrenergic, they kind of sound the same. So that's a great way to remember that those two neurotransmitters bind to those adrenergic receptors. All right, so thinking back to the bottom of page 123, do epinephrine and norepinephrine primarily work for your parasympathetic or your sympathetic branch? Sympathetic branch. So when you're under sympathetic dominance, what happens to your heart rate? Speeds up. Good. The neurotransmitters that tell your heart to speed up are epinephrine and norepinephrine. And of course, those are going to have an excitatory effect on those organs. During sympathetic response, what do we tell your digestive organs to do? Slow down. Right. So we may be looking at other kinds of, you know, neurotransmitters for that response, like acetylcholine. All right, notice that acetylcholine can work for both sympathetic response and parasympathetic response, but it's going to bring about different results from those organs. During sympathetic response, acetylcholine will calm your digestive organs, but during parasympathetic response, what does acetylcholine tell those organs to do? Speed up, right? So it depends on what response is the dominant response at that time. I do want to make a note about this. Notice that adrenaline and noradrenaline, they do not work for your parasympathetic response. They only work for your sympathetic response. Okay, so let me repeat that. Epinephrine or adrenaline, its buddy, norepinephrine or noradrenaline, only work for sympathetic control They do not work during parasympathetic control. Okay, so at your house, do you have a key that works more than one door? Maybe the back door, the front door, maybe have a side door even? Okay, so that one key can work on multiple doors. Go next door to the neighbor's house, that key works on nothing, right? Okay, so I would kind of think of the key that works on multiple doors at my house to be like a master key. And of course, it's a master for those locks in your house, but it does nothing for another lock, which it doesn't fit at all. Kind of think of it this way when we talk about these neurotransmitters. Adrenaline and noradrenaline, or epinephrine and norepinephrine, they work on only alpha and beta receptors. So it's kind of like having a master key that only works on those two receptors. That means that epinephrine and norepinephrine only can bind to those two. What I mean here is that epinephrine and norepinephrine don't bind to other houses, like, you know, your key doesn't work on the neighbors, so epinephrine and norepinephrine do not work on these two other receptors called cholinergic, nicotinic and muscarinic receptors. A different neurotransmitter binds them, it's acetylcholine. So it's kind of like the lock and key effect. If you have a key, it may be a master key for every door in your home, but it doesn't work on anybody else's locks, just on your locks. These neurotransmitters work very specifically on certain kinds of receptors. So epinephrine and norepinephrine work on these adrenergic receptors, alphas and betas. And acetylcholine works only on cholinergic receptors. Notice the name similarity there, choline and cholinergic. And their specific types are muscarinic and nicotinic. All right, so they looks like they started with the alphabet A and B, alpha and beta. And then all of a sudden they skip to M and N. So some crazy naming scheme there. I will tell you this, these nicotinic and muscarinic receptors actually come from what they were discovered on. You've heard of nicotine, right? What's that in?
Tobacco.
Tobacco, yeah, like cigarettes. So they discovered how it works through nicotine, and muscarine is actually a chemical found in mushrooms. So interesting background of where these two names came from. They should have just kept on naming ABCD, but nonetheless, that's where they discovered those two. I just want to review something with you from way back. We know on plasma membrane surfaces, there are receptors, and these receptors will bind certain things. So this is kind of what we talked about earlier. In order for a neurotransmitter to bind and activate something happening in this cell, it must have a receptor sitting on that plasma membrane. So, like we just talked, if the neurotransmitters epinephrine and norepinephrine, then the receptor must be an alpha receptor or a beta receptor. Flip it the other way, if your neurotransmitter is acetylcholine, the receptor sitting on that cell's membrane is going to be some type of nicotinic or muscarinic receptor. So it just depends on what the neurotransmitter is and if there's a receptor sitting on that membrane. So looking at this plasma membrane here, it has an alpha receptor sitting there, labeled there. If you had, say, acetylcholine come along, it could bind the alpha receptor, right? Epinephrine could bind it, norepinephrine could bind it. What if it is let's get a different picture. What if it is a different kind of receptor, like a muscarinic receptor? Could it bind epinephrine and norepinephrine? Maybe not, right? Because so the lock and key fit has to be a perfect or close to perfect fit there for this to actually work. Okay, so let's kind of look at this chart here, and instead of memorizing it, let's just talk about a way to get this stuff straight. Okay, during sympathetic activity, what happens to the heart rate? Speeds up. What neurotransmitter tells your heart rate to increase? You got it. Epinephrine and norepinephrine. And so epinephrine and norepinephrine can only bind what kinds of receptors? Alpha and beta. So guess what sits on your heart? Alpha and beta, right? Okay, so during sympathetic response, we want your heart rate to increase. We do that by using epinephrine and norepinephrine, and there must be alpha and beta receptors sitting here to help increase your heart rate. Going back to what we've done before, you know, when epinephrine comes over and binds one of these alpha or beta receptors, then we may either let sodium rush in, or in some way we may tell that heart or that heart cell to speed up its activity. So it's kind of the same story we've been doing all along. Now, during sympathetic response, while we're speeding up heart rate, we're telling the digestive organs to calm down, right? So we tell them to calm down, and we do that by not sending epinephrine and norepinephrine there, right? In fact, we are going to send a calming message using acetylcholine. So the general type of receptor on your digestive organs is what? Could be a nicotinic or muscarinic, right? So depending on which one we use, we calm those digestive organs. Flip it the other way, during parasympathetic response, now what message do we send to your heart? Calm down, right? And what is the only neurotransmitter that works for parasympathetic control? Acetylcholine. So acetylcholine tells your heart to slow down. It binds, you know, nicotinic or muscarinic receptors, and flip it in terms of digestive activity or urinary activity. Now we use acetylcholine to bind a different set of receptors and speed up that activity. So thinking about speeding up or slowing down activity, what we really talk about here is depolarization and hyperpolarization, that old stuff from a previous chapter. So what would you do to a cell that you want to speed up activity? Depolarize or hyperpolarize? Speed it up, depolarize it. And so what ions come in during depolarization? Let's see, if we let, say, epinephrine bind here, and this is a sodium channel, we now open it up and sodium comes in. So we can depolarize if we want to excite that cell. How do we hyperpolarize cells? What do we let escape?
Potassium.
So we may not bind a sodium channel, we may bind a potassium channel. So thinking back to those old terms, depolarization has to do with EPSPs, hyperpolarization has to do with IPSPs, that's it. So this is all we're doing, is we're either exciting cells with EPSPs or we're putting them to a resting state using IPSPs. So let me repeat this again. I would not advocate memorizing the chart. I think it's too much information on there, on that page 124. Let's just talk it through one more time. During sympathetic response is going to increase or depolarize your heart, making it beat faster. And so what neurotransmitters do that job? Epinephrine and norepinephrine, good. They're going to bind adrenergic receptors, and those adrenergic receptors are alphas and betas. Okay? During sympathetic response, we calm your digestive organs using a different neurotransmitter, and that is acetylcholine. Good. And it binds a different set of receptors. These down below here. All right. Flip-flop it. During parasympathetic control, we are using only acetylcholine, and acetylcholine calms your heart, and it increases the activity of your digestive organs. So do we send EPSPs or IPSPs to your heart? IPSPs to your heart, and you got it, EPSPs to your digestive organs, good. So like I said, I wouldn't memorize the chart, I would just think about what's happening during these two control mechanisms. I just wanted to mention some fun stuff to you, because now we can talk about drugs. There are drugs called alpha blockers, beta blockers. There's anticholinergic drugs. This is a whole field called pharmacy, right? This is pharmacology. So if you have a drug that is a blocker, then it's like putting a little plug in that receptor site, and putting a plug there prevents the epinephrine, norepinephrine, or acetylcholine from coming and binding. So whatever message those neurotransmitters are trying to communicate to your cell, what does the blocker say? can't do it, can't talk, right? They're talking to this cell. So as long as that drug is blocking that neurotransmitter, then that cell just basically sits there in response. If it continues doing whatever it should be doing, it's not going to respond through excitement or through rest. So if you take a beta blocker drug, beta blockers block what type of neurotransmitter? Yeah, epinephrine and norepinephrine. Those are mouthfuls, aren't they? So if you take a beta blocker and you block epinephrine or norepinephrine, what are you telling your heart rate to do?
Not to speed up.
Not to speed up, right. So I take one of these. I've got like an excitable heart. It gets really beating fast. Normal rate's like 75. Mine resting is like 95 or 100. So, you know, that can wear you out, right? So the beta blocker puts my heart resting rate back down closer to 75. So that's what beta blockers do. They lower the heart rate by blocking epinephrine and norepinephrine. Alpha blockers work in a similar way. They also block epinephrine and norepinephrine. They also decrease heart rate. And by the way, that is a question down there near the bottom of your page. What happens to heart rate when a person takes a beta blocker? It basically stays at a resting state, and that is because we block the effects of epinephrine. Okay, so heart rate stays slower, and that is because we block the effects of epinephrine. Do you think a beta blocker has much impact on your digestive organ activity? Not much, actually. There's not that many beta and alpha blockers on your digestive organs, so the greatest effect or greatest impact is going to be on your heart rate. Hey, just for fun, talking about cholinergic receptors like nicotinic or muscarinic receptors, if you block acetylcholine, and we're talking about parasympathetic control, what happens to your digestive organs? You have it. They don't get excited. They don't digest anything. And if your food doesn't move through your digestive tract, constipation, exactly. So there are lots of anticholinergic drugs. In fact, there's a lot that have that as a side effect. So no wonder constipation is a side effect of a lot of medications. So if you take an anticholinergic, you're taking something that ultimately will slow down your digestive processes. You can also impact, you know, being able to pee. You have to be able to relax your bladder muscles to pee. So urination can be impacted by an anticholinergic drug too. Even your eye muscles are not going to be able to relax, so your vision may be blurry if you take an anticholinergic drug. So, you know, a lot of these what we consider to be harmless over-the-counter medications can carry with them a side effect like what anticholinergic drugs actually do. Benadryl is one of those anticholinergics, you know, slows down the effects of acetylcholine. So this is really a great tip of the iceberg for pharmacology. All right, so that should wrap up that page for us. Like I mentioned, try to avoid memorizing the chart and just kind of talk yourself through it instead. How about any questions on that page? One little last bit here is just a little info about sensory input. That's 125. So sensory receptors in our bodies come in two forms. A lot of our sensory receptors are free nerve endings, what you have in your skin. That's why if you damage your skin greatly, then you'll burn off or damage those nerve endings and they can't regrow. There are other more important nerve endings, like those in your eye, that are encapsulated. And of course, if you damage an eyeball, it can't regrow. And if the damage is great enough, we may experience blindness from that damage. So specialized encapsulated nerve endings like the eye are not that common, but free nerve endings like what you've got on your skin, that's certainly way more common in our bodies. We classify sensory receptors by where they're located. This is good common sense stuff. XEX means where? Outside, yes. So those are the ones that tell you about the outside world. Those are touch receptors, temperature receptors in your skin, for instance. Inside receptors are interoceptors. They tell you about what's going on inside, like do you have a full bladder? Do you have an empty stomach? And we've talked a little bit about proprioceptors before. They're found specifically where? Muscles, yeah. Muscles and joints have proprioceptors, which is why you can close your eyes and still know where your body parts are in space. Sensory receptors behave in one of two ways. They are either tonic or they are phasic. Notice that tonic receptors are always generating a nerve impulse. Phasic receptors cut on and cut off. So they phase on and they phase off. So you'll notice that pain receptors are tonic. You can try your best to mentally block out pain. You can breathe through it. You can distract yourself from it, but that pain is still there. You know it's still there. We have to take pain blockers in order to block ourselves from getting messages from those pain receptors. That's because they're always on. Why is it probably a good thing that pain receptors are always on? What does pain indicate? You're in danger. Yeah, you're hurting from something. So it's probably good for us to know if there's something wrong, that the pain doesn't go away. That means something is still not right. Phasic receptors are ones that will cut off. Basically, they're off until they're needed. So you don't need to know about the temperature in this room unless it drastically gets hotter or colder. Those are phasic receptors. You don't need to know about your clothes. Those are phasic receptors. You know, those touch receptors are phasic. And these phasic receptors are actually prone to adaptation. That means the resting state of that nerve cell is going to be set more and more negative. So if normal resting state for a nerve cell is negative 70 millivolts, what does it mean if it becomes more negative? Negative 80? Next time it's negative 90? What are we doing to these cells? Yeah, hyperpolarization. So what are these cells saying? You really have to bug me if you want to get the message to the brain, because as they adapt, they're going to hyperpolarize, meaning you have to have a greater stimulus with more sodium flooding in to generate a nerve impulse. So they say that your tongue taste buds actually hyperpolarize and adapt. They say the first bite of a food is the most delicious, most flavorful that you can have. And 20, 50 bites later, it's not so fantastic anymore because your taste buds have adapted to that food. They say that if you're trying to control calories, the first 5 or so bites are the greatest you're going to have of that meal. After that dessert is, 5 bites in, put it away because it's just going to kind of adapt and not be quite as flavorful after that. I don't know that we notice it that much, the diminishment of tasting, but that is one of the types of phasic receptors, it actually does adapt. The last thing down there is just types of receptors by stimulus. Noce or nocioceptors are pain receptors. They're always on, so they are tonic in nature. What do thermoreceptors detect? Temperature, right. So if you put a warm heating pad against your skin, that's a thermoreceptor that will feel that. If you put an ice cube on you, that's a thermoreceptor, we'll detect that. We've got several types of mechanoreceptors. They detect some kind of physical change in your skin. We actually did talk about these back in the skin chapter. Tactile receptors detect light touch on your skin. What do baroreceptors detect? Pressure, yeah. So they are found not only outside on your skin surface, but they're also found inside. Baroreceptors tell you that you've got a full stomach. You feel the pressure from a full stomach. They also tell us that we have a full bladder and it's time to pee. So these pressure receptors are outside in your cutaneous membranes, but also inside your body too. And then once again, there's proprioceptors in our joints and muscles telling us about our body's positions in space. The final type of general sensory receptor is a chemical detector. These are oftentimes found in your taste buds. They detect what's going on in your mouth. We also have them in our bodies because we're looking for certain levels of ions. So we'll talk more about chemoreceptors and baroreceptors in Bio-211. They are a big deal when it comes to regulating heart rate, blood pressure, even thirst is regulated by what those receptors are telling your brain. So this is kind of leading us into, you know, a Bio-211 conversation. All right, so that takes us to the end of this chapter. Page 126, which is a discussion page, is just the last page for us in this chapter. So, floor is now yours. What kind of questions do you have for Tuesday? Anything I can go back and repeat for you? I do want you to know I check email throughout the weekend. If you are having a burning question that you want to send, feel free. I'll be happy to answer it for you over the weekend. Mondays, I'm around in the office down the hall, 5316. And like normal, I'll be happy to start you early on the test Tuesday if you would like to get the anxious jitters out of your system, that sympathetic response, right? If you want to start early on Tuesday, I'll be happy to come down here for you. Okay, anything that we need to go back and hit one more time? Anything that we've covered today that you need to hear again?